You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. The incumbent for the Ward 1 seat on the Astoria City Council says he will not run again. KMUN's Katie Frankowitz reports.
On Friday, Andy Davis told KMUN he will be moving out of his ward once his term expires at the end of December. Davis was elected in 2022 to represent the Uniontown area. Starting next year, however, he will be living in the downtown Ward 3 area. He says he's been approached about running for the Ward 3 seat, currently held by Elizabeth Adams, or trying for the role of mayor, currently held by Sean Fitzpatrick. But Davis says he isn't sure he will run yet. For now, he wants to encourage people to run for his Ward 1 seat, assuring them they will not be facing an incumbent. Adams has indicated she plans to run again for her Ward 3 seat. Fitzpatrick has not committed himself to trying for a second term as mayor. Fitzpatrick ran unopposed in 2022 and previously served on the Astoria Planning Commission. Sean Davis, a combat veteran and the co-founder of the nonprofit Rogue Cell, is officially a candidate in the mayoral race. As of last week, he had gathered and had verified the signatures he needed to proceed. Davis announced his plans to run for mayor earlier this year. While no other challengers for the office have emerged yet, Davis hopes to see others in the race. Filing closes for incumbents on August 18th and for all other candidates on August 25th. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting.
This year's race for Oregon governor could be highly competitive, according to internal data being circulated by one candidate. Republican Christine Drazen says her polling shows she is leading Governor Tina Kotek. Dirk Vanderhart reports.
The poll of 600 voters suggests Drazen had 48% to Kotek's 44%. 6% of voters were undecided. The findings are within the poll's margin of error, so not conclusive. And many Democrats will take the results with a grain of salt, since they came from the Republican campaign. But the poll isn't the only sign that the governor's race could be competitive. On Friday, the nonpartisan Cook Political Report moved its rating of the contest from solid Democratic to likely Democratic. It's the second analysis firm to shift its rating toward Republicans in recent weeks. Republicans this year believe Oregonians are outraged over the direction of the state. They're banking on voters to buck decades of precedent and bounce an incumbent Democrat. Kotek's campaign, meanwhile, has tirelessly worked to link Drazen's politics with those of unpopular President Donald Trump. I'm Dirk Vanderhart, reporting.
A federal appeals court once again heard arguments about the Department of Homeland Security use of crowd control weapons during protests outside the Portland ICE building. Judges in Oregon previously limited when federal officers could use tear gas and other force. They sided with protesters and neighbors who live close to the ICE facility who sued, saying their constitutional rights were violated. Earlier this year, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals heard the case for the first time and ultimately sided with the Trump administration. During the hearing, Matthew Borden, one of the attorneys for the protesters, pushed for the appeals court to allow limits on force.
The thing is, you cannot just go whole hog against the crowd unless there's actual reason to do it. And that isn't present on this record, and that is what the district court found.
Attorneys for the Justice Department, however, argued officers need crowd control weapons to deal with unruly protests. It's unclear when the Ninth Circuit will rule. For decades, companies have wanted to restart mining nickel in southern Oregon. As Jefferson Public Radio's Justin Higginbottom reports, a changing market and pro-mining administration might finally bring the industry back to the state.
Homeland Nickel CEO Steve Balch is driving with a team of geologists and business partners up winding roads within the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest.
We are in the largest ultramafic rock complex in North America. It's called the Josephine Ophiolite.
What makes this stretch of geology special is that the soil has low amounts of silica and can carry high amounts of metals, like nickel, which is what brings Balch here today. Homeland Nickel has a mining claim nearby.
So this is laterite. What you're seeing here is 1% nickel.
Road cuts reveal laterite, this reddish soil high in iron. It's what gives the 2,000-acre mining claim nearby its name, Red Flat. Robert Osborne is a geologist who specializes in nickel laterite. He likes what he sees.
You take that and you take it in your hands, it's crumbly.
He takes out a magnet and waves it over the red soil in his hand. It sticks. That means there's iron in this laterite. It's a good sign there's nickel below. Balch estimates Red Flat has over 300 million pounds of the metal. That's only one of nine claims Homeland Nickel has in southern Oregon. Balch thinks a nearby site named Cleopatra holds over 700 million pounds of nickel.
By tons, our Cleopatra deposit is the single largest nickel deposit in the United States.
That's besides a large, low-grade deposit in Alaska. So if there's so much nickel in southern Oregon, why hasn't it been mined? One reason is that there's been enough on the global market. Right now, most nickel comes from Chinese-run mines in Indonesia.
Calling Indonesia the Saudi Arabia of nickel is actually an insult to Indonesia because its market share is vastly larger than that of Saudi Arabia with respect to oil.
That's Colin Hendricks with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says demand could soon outpace supply. Historically, nickel was mostly used in stainless steel products, but future demand is expected to come from electric vehicle batteries. The International Energy Agency says nickel demand will nearly double by 2040. The only current U.S. nickel mine is in Michigan and slated to close in 2030.
I think that the real unknowns are what kind of policies the U.S. puts in place to support not just the domestic nickel industry, but also many of the other kind of critical mineral supply chains and industries.
The largest nickel mine in U.S. history was in Douglas County. The Riddle Mine operated for decades with crucial support from the federal government. After the mine closed in 1998, neighbors complained of lingering health concerns over exposure to air pollution. Michael Dotson is with the conservation group Klamath Siskiyou Wildland Center. He says plans for nickel mining in southern Oregon and pushback from environmental groups is nothing new.
Concerned communities back in the 80s and early 90s seeing the nickel mining as a threat to their watersheds, that was a big impetus to organize and secure protections for Northwest California's Smith River National Recreation Area.
Those concerned communities helped put a 20-year ban on new mining claims on over 100,000 acres of federal land in southwestern Oregon. But historic claims like Homeland Nickel's Red Flat area can move forward with a Forest Service permit. Dotson says that would be devastating for the pristine environment.
We're talking about a form of probably strip mining in order to find small traces of the mineral.
Balch with Homeland Nickel understands why people oppose mining in the area.
The mining industry has treated the environment like crap. I don't think anyone disputes that.
But he says byproducts left after removing nickel from this laterite are non-toxic, and his company is required to restore native vegetation after mining. While there remains distrust from those concerned about the environment, his company may have a friend in the White House. President Trump has directed agencies to speed up the permitting process. Balch says it used to take over a year for the Forest Service to even respond to a permit request.
Since the Trump administration has become involved indirectly with our file, we're getting very timely response from the Forest Service kind of on a weekly basis.
Despite concerns over the environment, the current administration and growing market might bring nickel back to Oregon for the first time in 20 years. I'm Justin Higginbottom in Curry County.
Last week, a family in Central Oregon filed a lawsuit against Knife River Mining Company over unsafe well water. Jen Bides reports.
For the last 5 years, Ashley McCormick and her family have experienced worsening water quality from their well at their home north of Prineville in Crook County. The McCormicks are a family of five. Their lawsuit alleges that toxic contaminants entered the groundwater through Knife River's mining activity near their home. The process is used to extract sand and gravel from farmland for making concrete. The family's lawsuit seeks over $25 million in damages. State health officials sampled water from nearly 60 wells in the area and found that dozens of them contained unhealthy levels of heavy metals like manganese, lead, and arsenic. Knife River officials have denied responsibility for polluting the groundwater. Instead, company representatives point to the natural makeup of the land as the source of contaminants. Jen Bides reporting.
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Now moving to news from Washington. Democrats in Washington state are working to flip a few Republican seats in the legislature this year. One of those seats is in farm country in central Washington. State government reporter Sarah Mises-Tan files this report.
The sun is beating down on us as Giovanni Severino and I are door knocking in Yakima.
No dogs are coming. So.
We're in the heart of the 14th Legislative District, the most Latino district in the state. Severino is an organizer with Progreso, a nonprofit dedicated to getting out the Latino vote. He's walking house to house with a plastic clipboard.
So these are our shields. I like to call them our shields because they become shields sometimes. And then inside, we have a sample ballot with us to show people what the ballot looks like. Sometimes.
This district is one of a handful that state Democrats are trying to win in November. There are two state House seats up for election here that typically go to Republicans. Democratic strategists, like Stephen Paolini, say dissatisfaction with Republicans on a national scale could push more people to vote blue this fall.
So in general, this year is worse for Republicans. It's a midterm year after they just won the presidency, not just in the congressional level, but also at the local level as well.
But Yakima presents both a challenge and an opportunity for Democrats. It's a deeply Republican district, but it also has very low voter turnout. And the fact that it's a Latino majority district, Democrats say, is a plus.
The Latino community is not loyal to the Democrats. They're not loyal to the Republicans. They're looking for who is going to speak to the issues that they are feeling. And I think this year we have a great opportunity as Democrats to really dive into that.
Yakima resident Xochitl Flores is one of those swing voters. She doesn't identify as Democrat or Republican. She runs a daycare on a quiet neighborhood block and talks to us after all the kids have gone home. She says she's most worried about immigration this election season.
People doesn't want to even go out on the streets. Everybody is a human and everybody deserves to be able to go outside and feel free. That's why we came to this country.
When we ask if she knows who represents her in Olympia,
I am not aware of that. I should, but I'm not. I'm just being busy with children and I've been busy with the school, so I haven't had a lot of time to do that.
This fall, she'll see Republican incumbents Gloria Mendoza and Deb Manjarrez on her ballot, along with Democratic challengers Chelsea Demas and Ezekiel Morfin. Another reason why Democrats see these House seats as vulnerable is because of how the district's boundaries are drawn. Several years ago, the state redrew its electoral maps. Many of Central Washington's Latino votes used to be spread over two legislative districts and are now in just one. But state Republican Party Chair Jim Walsh says Yakima Democrats don't have a chance. Republicans have prevailed here since redistricting, and Walsh says they'll probably keep winning.
They've done a good job representing the people of their district and have earned the goodwill of the people to be reelected. Nothing has changed. I mean, we'll see what happens in November, but no, the Washington State Republican Party does not consider the 14th District particularly vulnerable.
At the end of the day, this all means canvasser Giovanni Severino has his work cut out for him, door knocking under the hot Yakima sun. Ballots for the August primary will be mailed out in the next few weeks. In Yakima, I'm Sarah Mises-Tan.
Hola, buenas tardes. Good afternoon.
Hola, buenas. Hola. Hi, ¿se encuentra Beiri Suarez de Bollo?
A nonprofit's food bank that distributes food to pantries across five counties in southeastern Washington is serving hundreds more people, but it's receiving less than half the amount of food compared to last year. NWPB's Eric Bengel reports.
Blue Mountain Action Council partners with food pantries in Walla Walla, Columbia, Franklin, Garfield, and Assotin counties. Between April 2025 and April 2026, it began serving hundreds more people. In Franklin County, the number grew by 15%. Danielle Garby-Reeser is the nonprofit's CEO.
In the last year, food prices themselves are up, gas prices are up, electricity is up, rent is up, and so people are having to make really hard choices about how to make ends meet.
She says the drop in food shipments is largely due to the Federal Department of Agriculture scaling back food assistance programs. In Walla Walla, I'm Eric Bengel.
Washington's proposed cell phone ban in public schools is popular with teachers and parents on the Long Beach Peninsula. Under Governor Bob Ferguson's proposal, cell phones and smart devices would be banned during school hours in K-12 public schools. If legislation is signed into law, Washington would join at least 31 other states in restricting students' use of cell phones in schools. On the Long Beach Peninsula, Ilwaco's Hilltop Middle School is already tech-free during lunch. Hilltop Middle School principal Sherry Lloyd says cell phones make it difficult for students to stay engaged. She supports the statewide ban. She says the school's existing policy has reduced students' cell phone use, but that the school still has issues with students playing games on school computers and using artificial intelligence to complete work. The Chinook Observer asked parents how they felt about the prospective ban, and most were supportive. One parent says that while she's in favor of the ban, it may be harmful to older students who have professional and personal responsibilities outside of school. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. North County's only animal shelter is moving. Harbor Association of Volunteers for Animals in Raymond has been looking for a new location for almost a year. Julie McQueary, the shelter's president, says that increased demand, an influx of kittens, and necessity for room fuel the need to expand. With community support, the shelter was able to secure the former Flowers by Lynn building along US 101. McQueary says the larger facility will allow them to house more cats and advocate more effectively for responsible pet management. The shelter is currently seeking volunteers to join them in their rescue efforts. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. The Seattle Indian Health Board is reopening its Thunderbird Treatment Center at a new 92-bed facility on Vashon Island to help more people access addiction treatment. Officials gathered over the weekend for its ribbon cutting. KNKX's Mitch Borden reports.
The new Thunderbird Treatment Center has been years in the making, ever since the Seattle Indian Health Board closed its South Seattle rehab facility in 2020. The nonprofit has invested $36 million into its new location on Vashon Island. Esther Lucero, the CEO of the Seattle Indian Health Board, says the island will be a wonderful place for people to get away and reset.
You need to step away from some of those vices that have fueled your addiction, or maybe those experiences of trauma that have initiated, you know, your movement towards substances.
Lucero says the treatment center will serve both Native American and non-Native patients. The majority of its beds will be available to people who qualify for Medicaid and Medicare. The 92-bed facility is expected to begin welcoming patients later this year. I'm Mitch Borden, reporting.
Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Just days after the U.S. Supreme Court decided that a president could remove personnel at most independent federal agencies without cause, the remaining commissioners at the U.S. Election Assistance Commission were removed by President Trump. Should we worry? The EAC's website says its mission is to help election officials improve the administration of elections and help Americans participate in the voting process. It works, quote, to protect the nation's election equipment, support election officials, serve voters, and ultimately help make elections safe, secure, accurate, and accessible, unquote. July 9th, two of its four commissioners were removed via email by President Trump without cause, and a third resigned. The fourth commissioner resigned in May. Replacements require a presidential nomination and Senate confirmation, but don't hold your breath. The similarly organized Federal Election Commission has only two of six bipartisan seats filled, rendering it inoperable since early 2025. The Center for Democracy and Technology suggests EAC staff can function as is, but with no commissioners, can make no new policy or modify programs. But paired with FEC's paralysis and the gutting of cybersecurity agency CISA, it does put the midterm at risk from foreign or administration election interference. We've linked to more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.